When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello and welcome to this encore episode of the Psychology Talk podcast. Welcome to the Psychology Talk podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Scott Hoy. The Psychology Talk podcast is a unique conversation about psychology and behavioral health from around the globe. We help you expand your knowledge by connecting you in conversation with experts in the field. Topics include hypnosis and mind-body treatments, breakthroughs in neuroscience and psychology, social and ethical considerations of behavioral health and psychology, and international trends in mental health and wellness. While you're listening, please take a moment to subscribe to us and give us a like or a review. It helps us to grow and continue to provide you with quality information and interviews. And now, here is the episode. Hello, everybody. Today, my guest on the Psychology Talk podcast is Dr. Ron Ambar. Dr. Ambar is a board-certified pediatric pulmonologist and a general pediatrician. He's a leader in the field of clinical hypnosis and has 20 years of experience treating children. He has also served as a professor of pediatrics and medicine and the director of pediatric pulmonology at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, for which he was at 21 years. Dr. Ambar has also worked as a guest editor and advisory editor for the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis. He has directed more than 20 clinical workshops, that's a lot, on the subject of pediatric hypnosis. In addition to his teaching and lecturing experiences, Dr. Ambar has been the principal investigator in 10 published case studies of pediatric hypnosis and involved in research trials of children with cystic fibrosis and other pulmonary disorders. He's a published author of more than 50 articles, abstracts, and book chapters on pediatric functional disorders and pediatric hypnosis. Thank you. That's a very busy schedule. Thank you for coming to the show, Dr. Ambar. Today, you will be talking about your new book. Can you tell us about that?
So thank you very much for having me. So my new book is called Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, A Journey to the Center. And it's a story of my hypnosis experiences over the past 2 decades of working with children. I've learned a lot about what hypnosis is and is not and how to help children help themselves.
Okay, cool. Well, I had a chance to nip into the book a bit, and I've enjoyed it quite immensely. It has a kind of conversational style to it, because I sense that it's not just for people like myself, a clinician who might work with hypnosis with a child, but also for parents. It looks like it's for what we would deem the consumer's consumption.
Correct. So my whole idea about this book was to bring the idea of how hypnosis can be helpful to people, to the consumers, to the parents, to the adolescents, the children themselves. Mm-hmm. There are many books out there, professional books about what hypnosis is. There's some excellent texts out there. There are many books about how to do hypnosis for the public. I didn't want to write any of those. I wanted to just raise public awareness of how mind-body medicine can improve their lives.
Excellent. Yeah, and it does that. It is readily consumable on it's very open to people to learn and understand that. Well, tell us a little bit more, like go into depth about why in particular hypnosis with a pediatric clientele.
So first of all, I'm a pediatric pulmonologist, as you mentioned, and I fell into this with a particular patient who was very allergic to milk products. In fact, twice in his life, he almost died from eating milk product. And he came to me one day and he said, "Lately, when I've been smelling cheeseburgers, I've been developing asthma attacks." I thought that was a weird symptom. I wondered if a milk molecule might be wafting in the air and affecting him, which, by the way, cannot really happen.
Okay.
And I asked him, could you please imagine eating a cheeseburger, which is something he could not do in real life? He did so, and within seconds, he developed what appeared to be an asthma attack. And I told him to stop it because I was worried he'd have a bad allergic reaction. And I said, wait a minute, you brought yourself into such an extreme condition with your imagination. Can you use your imagination to bring yourself out? And later I found out that was hypnosis. That was my rather dramatic introduction to the field.
So you learned from experience what hypnosis precisely is. Yeah.
Correct. And I wanted to send him off to a hypnotherapist who could help teach him what to do. I didn't know anything about hypnosis at the time. And he didn't want to go. He didn't want to see a psychologist. He said, I have enough doctors already. I want to work with you. And I said, that's nice. I don't know much about this. And he said, I don't care. Teenager. So I went to my friend, Dr. David Keith, a psychiatrist at Upstate where I used to work, and he told me he would back me up. He had known about my clinical work before because we had done consultations together. And he told me all good physicians do hypnosis whether they realize it or not. Part of good medicine involves psychology, and encouraged me to learn more about the field. It would augment my ability to be a good physician. So with that backing, I started reading about it, and I practiced with my first patient for a year as we learned together about what hypnosis can do.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So you basically jumped right in. Most people, when they go to workshops, for those of you out there who aren't clinicians, you learn a technique and you practice it with people in a not so clinical environment of a workshop, but you do get some kind of a taster of what you're supposed to do. But from my own experience learning hypnosis, I will admit, as a lay hypnotist and later on studying it more in depth in psych school, it's usually taught, and most people are very scared, as I was when I first started doing hypnosis. It became this, it was this thing. It wasn't, you learned it kind of surreptitiously, you did something with the patient. So it probably wasn't as scary for you knowing that you'd already done it, and you could just kind of learn a bit more and figure out more techniques and how the mind kind of works.
Correct. Well, as a physician, you, especially in the olden days, we were encouraged and needed to just, if we weren't comfortable with something, just move forward. At one point, I was in charge of intensive care unit because the intensivists had quit, so I had to take over. And I wasn't particularly comfortable, but I was the one physician who could do it. And my training as a physician, we would be placed in the hospital as the only physician, even though we were just days out of medical school and you had to fly by the wing of your pants. You have to just do what you can. So as early on, I learned how to think on my feet and just move forward, even if I wasn't completely comfortable, which was also true with hypnosis for me.
Well, okay. So it sounds like there was more of an improvisational kind of quality to the learning experience back in the good old days, as they say.
Correct. So you would help the patients, but then you'd increase your knowledge base. You'd ask, you'd consult with people, you'd read about it, and keep refining the kind of work you did. And I applied that to hypnosis as well. One of the advantages of learning this way is I wasn't encumbered by knowing how you're supposed to do things and how you're not supposed to do things. So, for example, very early on in my hypnosis career with this first patient, I had read about inner motor signaling, and I talked to his subconscious with yes-no answers, and very quickly I got bored with getting yes or no responses, so I asked, would you talk to me? And the subconscious said yes. So then I had a verbal interaction, which was quite dramatic, and I learned quite a bit about the resources a subconscious can give you, especially in a patient who was really good at hypnosis, as it turned out to be. My first patient turned out to be. And later I learned you can type with the subconscious, you can draw with the subconscious, a lot of things you can do with it. A couple years later, I found out about societies of hypnosis about half a year into my experience and started taking some workshops. And I attended a workshop where a seasoned clinician presented a case of a complicated 40-year-old lady, and he said, what would you do next? And I said, well, I would talk to her subconscious and find out what it has to say and be guided by that. He says, you can't do that. That's not possible. And I thought to myself, well, not only is it possible, I'm doing it, but I didn't say that. And that's thing, there's still attitude like that. People find it surprising. I've just started giving presentations at ASH about interacting with the subconscious. And for a lot of people, it's new, just the direct kind of interaction. In fact, this coming March, I'm giving a workshop where it's going to be experiential. We're going to practice talking directly to the subconscious. And I'm learning from having taught a handful of people this past year, it's not inherently obvious to people how to do that. So I'm in the process of teaching people that now.
I think that that idea of the subconscious has kind of been thrown to the wayside, and yet you could easily frame most people's psychological or psychiatric issues as some kind of a debate between parts within the mind that they're not aware of, right?
So, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Like ego state therapy, as I understand it, is sort of like parts of the mind with different agendas. Or, you know, I think that what's remarkable to me is that young children's subconsciouses can sort of explain their psychological issues. So, for example, there was a 12-year-old girl who I saw with vocal cord dysfunction. That's a condition in which the vocal cords close down when you try to inhale, so you can't breathe very well. Typically, this occurs in high-achieving teenage female athletes. So the stress they put on themselves when they run causes them to close the vocal cords, typically misdiagnosed as asthma, and sometimes treated inappropriately with things like tonsillectomies and Botox injections to the vocal cords.
Good Lord.
But typically with one session of relaxation using hypnosis, the symptom resolves. This is one of the simpler medical issues. So the girl I'm telling you about is 12 years old. She presented with vocal cord dysfunction. It was diagnosed because she had a scope put into her nasopharynx, and you could see that her vocal cords were closing when they were supposed to open. So that's, we saw that she had the diagnosis. I taught her hypnosis, and the symptom did not clear. I told her I wanted to send her to a speech therapist, which is how you can teach people how to breathe differently, and she didn't want to go. So a week later, symptoms still hadn't relieved with hypnosis, so I had her undergo an MRI to make sure she didn't have a brain problem, which she did not. And then I said, there must be something going on. Let's talk to your subconscious. So this, we did some typing, and in the subconscious, I asked the subconscious what was going on. She said, well, the girl saw her stepfather selling drugs, and she didn't want to tell her mother what had happened because it would disrupt the marriage, and therefore she made sure she couldn't talk. This is subconscious speaking in third person. She was explaining a conversion disorder. This 12-year-old explaining conversion disorder.
Yeah.
And so I talked to her, and I said, well, can't you convince yourself, or can't you trust yourself? And the subconscious said, I suppose I can, but if she starts talking, I'll make sure she can't talk again. And the symptoms stopped right there in the middle of the session after 3 weeks. So that's an example of one young person, 12-year-old, explaining conversion disorder. I remember another, a 13-year-old boy, a lacrosse player, who was right-handed but played left-handed in his sports. And I asked his subconscious where he's located, he says, in the right brain, that's why I'm left-handed. And I asked the boy if he had taken psychology courses, and he said no. He seemed to have this awareness. So little kids or teenagers seem to have an awful lot of knowledge at this subconscious level. That's just a couple quick examples.
Well, that's a pretty amazing. He had no like explicit memory of right-left hemisphere theory, which it has been debated since it came out like in the 60s or 70s, right? But it seems to be coming back into the field of acceptance. But how interesting. And I'm just curious, like, as you were working with that child, like, that would be like contralateral, right? So the right side of the brain would control the left half of the body.
Yep.
Right.
He was correct anatomically. Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. That's amazing. Did you go any further with that? Did you explore that? I mean, you were looking to help the child out, the adolescent out, but yeah.
Well, I didn't go much further with him. I think that I've always thought of the subconscious being a lot of right brain activity for a number of reasons. One is we know that the speech center is in the left brain, and we know from split brain patients that you can have two different brains if they're not connected. The subconscious often seems to be more artistic and mathematically oriented, in my experience, which are right brain things. I think a lot of subconscious, what I call subconscious, and we should say, for my patients, I tell them the subconscious is the part of your brain you're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, it's below conscious awareness. But I don't think it's the simplest thing. The subconscious is in the right brain, but it's an interesting question of where it's located. I'd love to do functional MRI studies and see when the subconscious, quote unquote, speaks. Do you have a particular location it's coming from?
Yeah, it might be a costly study, but you know, if enough case studies, it would be certainly interesting. Do you have any guess where it might be coming from? You might have a hypothesis, or you just like would want to see what the results were.
Well, I think in a person with an intact brain who's talking to me, then it's got it. If the subconscious, like, say, if you do automatic talking, Ernest Hilgard's Hidden Observer,
correct,
they're
yeah.
talking. So it's got
yeah.
to be processed, at least in part, through the left brain. But I think it does originate in the right brain. I have this idea. Are you familiar with acquired savants?
A little bit, yeah.
So my understanding is that people who have a left brain injury will sometimes come up with an ability that they never had before, like a savant ability, like musical or mathematical ability. And scientists explain that as somehow the left brain must have been inhibiting that ability, presumably in the right brain, or I guess it could be within the left brain, but it was something the left brain was inhibiting the ability. When the injury occurred, it was disinhibited. I personally have a problem with that. I can't imagine that. It doesn't make sense to me that you'd have such great ability that be repressed your whole life and that an injury uncovers it. So I wonder whether the right brain, part of its abilities is to, this is radical, but it's my thought, part of its ability is to interact from outside the person themselves, sort of like maybe Jungian's unconscious, collective unconscious idea.
Okay.
And so what's inhibited perhaps by the left brain is this ability to interact outside of yourself, and when that's disinhibited, you can tap into things you don't normally tap into. I've done those studies. It's just my thoughts.
Okay, it's intriguing. It's a cool hypothesis. Well, you know, we're talking about hypnosis and the mind-body connection, and you did touch upon in the book. You do touch upon in the book a bit about like the difference between hypnosis, which is not as well known. Maybe we're on the precipice or the cusp of a new renaissance of hypnosis in used in clinical work. Maybe not. We don't know. But meditation has seemed to, mindfulness especially, which you're probably familiar with Michael Yapko and his book on mindfulness and meditation and hypnosis and the differences between, you know, a very clinical or look at the difference in scripts and similarities, and possibly where a lot of the nomenclature and the verbiage from mindfulness scripts come from. You could say it's probably was swiped from old hypnosis scripts, you know, to a certain degree. But maybe you can clarify the difference for people out there who might be saying, well, what's the difference between this, Dr. Ambar?
Sure, and I swipe things from mindfulness, so it's
yes, of course, yes. It's a heyday of borrowing those one-liners. Yeah.
Well, to my mind, mindfulness and hypnosis both change mindsets, so that they have that in common. But the goals of mindfulness are different from the goals of hypnosis. So typically, mindfulness involves focusing on a single idea or mantra or the breath and mm-hmm. letting go of all other ideas. So the goal of mindfulness is to let go of ideas. If they come through, don't attend to them, let them pass. And we know from studies of mindfulness, if you do it 20, 30 minutes a day, a couple times a day for a couple of months, that you actually will see structural brain changes that take place from mm-hmm. mindfulness. Hypnosis, on the other hand, is has a goal. So you typically will start with a peaceful mind, but it doesn't have to be a calm mind. And then you give yourself a suggestion, or a therapist gives you suggestions to make a change. So it's more goal directed. So those are the major differences in my mind. I would add that I think the reason mindfulness perhaps has been taken up better than hypnosis, it does not carry the baggage hypnosis has, the Hollywood-induced baggage.
Yes, Hollywood and just, yeah.
Popular literature.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the idea that someone's controlling you, but, you know, that's of course not what happens. And you do take a while to kind of dispel some of those myths and fears. Maybe you could speak to that for the audience out there who's a generalist in the audience or not aware of hypnosis.
Right. So first of all, the misconceptions are that hypnosis involves mind control, that it's going to sleep, it's doing things against your will, an evildoer can make you commit crimes. That's sort of that's what is implied in Hollywood and in magic shows. And I will start off with every patient explaining all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. You do not do hypnosis without your participation. Number one. And number two, hypnosis is not sleep. When you do hypnosis, you know what's going on. You can stop any time because you're in control of the experience. And number three, it's not unusual. We all do hypnosis all the time. If you're in a boring lecture and you start daydreaming, that's hypnosis. If you're driving a car 3 miles down the road and you said, "How'd I get here?" that's hypnosis. If you watch children doing their pretend play, that's hypnosis. So hypnosis is not an unusual state of mind. It's just that in that state of mind, you can be more accepting of suggestions. The reason, by the way, that you're more accepting of suggestions is that you park your conscious mind, the critical mind, in hypnosis, and then the subconscious mind can accept more of the suggestions. So, for example, if I'm going to teach somebody how to become more comfortable with their chronic pain, if I just said to them, "Well, turn off your pain," they'd say, "What do you mean? I can't do that." But if they're in a hypnotic state and I say, "Reduce your pain or turn it off," they'll do it, they'll work at it as much as possible. And some of the people are good enough at hypnosis, they can actually say, "I feel no pain anymore."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, right. And so it's more volition, more control on the part of the person who's experiencing the hypnosis.
Correct. Now, since your audience is... some of your audience is more sophisticated than the average general public, I'd also add that if it behooves you not to know what's going on in hypnosis, like for therapeutic purposes. So, for example, let's say, so that it's possible to interact with hypnosis and not recall it. And that can be beneficial if you have something traumatic happened to you or something you have a very difficult time talking about. In hypnosis, better able to verbalize it. So like the girl I told you about earlier who saw her stepfather selling drugs, she did not know that in a conscious level. It was too much for her to handle. And that's why she developed a conversion disorder. But her subconscious was able to express it. And when it expressed it to me, she did not know what it was. The resolution occurred outside of her awareness.
Okay. All right.
So she just got better. She didn't know why.
And that's sometimes fine, right? There are people that just, do you really need to know how CBT works or psychodynamics work, right? Doesn't matter, you know. Do you care when you take your car to the mechanic how they did it? You don't really care, most people. They just want to have their car working, their brakes function. Yeah. Yeah.
Correct.
Excellent. Yeah. And that can be very helpful, very convenient for people, and can sometimes make it seem like magic.
Yeah. And again, it's important for us who want hypnosis to be taken more seriously to explain it's not magic. It may appear magical. And we all have magical abilities, if you like, within us, but it's not magic. And,
okay.
And I think in order to dispel the problems that hypnosis had in uptake, we all of us who practice hypnosis need to be very careful to enunciate that.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. You had a remarkable, to me, a quote that stuck out is pretty remarkable. You said, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase here, kind of quote, you have a body of clinical experience showing hypnosis to be the most, I can't even read my own handwriting, most powerful underutilized tool in pediatric care today. That's a pretty heavy quote, and that's a great quote. Tell me what's behind that.
Well, first of all, the majority of symptoms in children, and probably adults as well, is this affected by the psychology, affected by stress.
Absolutely.
And therefore, we must, if we're going to be holistic physicians, if we're going to do the best we can for our patients, we must address psychology, which in Western medicine, we fail miserably at doing so. And I think a lot of alternative medicine is because Western medicine does not address psychology. So then the question is, how do you address psychology? I believe hypnosis is the simplest tool, the most available tool, the most accessible tool, and the most effective tool of the things we have. What other tools do we have? We talked about meditation earlier. Meditation, done well, takes half hour a day, ongoing. It's non-directed, so it takes a while to get to a goal. Most kids won't take the time to do that. You have talk therapy. You could talk for a year and avoid talking about what's really bothering you. You've got cognitive behavioral therapy that gives you specific kinds of ways of approaching challenges. That takes time, and it takes identifying the correct challenges and the child's cooperation. Yoga. I mean, yoga is takes a while to have an effect. It's also non-directed. You have biofeedback. Biofeedback requires multiple visits. What tools do we have? Hypnosis. I can teach a child in 5 minutes what to do. Sometimes that's curative. 5 minutes of instruction. And then I can't think of a more powerful tool.
Wow, 5 minutes and a couple follow-up sessions and they might be good to go.
My average medical patient with medical issues, I see four times. That's all, four sessions. If patients come to me with psychological issues, anxiety, depression, that can take many sessions. But that's because you're dealing with how to cope. It's not the symptom caused by psychology is much more complex than a child stressed out by their inability to breathe from asthma. So take, for example, a child with asthma attacks. They can't breathe. They get nervous. They're going to, if next time they can't breathe, they might end up in an emergency room or in a hospital. Mm-hmm. Natural reaction. Mm-hmm. And that stress, that anxiety causes them to develop shortness of breath. You could teach them how to calm themselves by simple exercise. Go to your safe, relaxing place and know how to trigger that quickly. And that's all it takes. And once you know how to do that, they don't panic anymore when they have an asthma flare up. And suddenly the asthma becomes much easier to manage. Very simple.
Yeah. Well, I think the biopsychosocial model, right, that used to be used quite a bit in psychotherapy and psychiatry, I think is a very, and I think in medicine too. If you can engage someone to change their physiology, and especially when it comes to breath work, I found that can be a great gives people hope for those who have anxiety, you know, typically those who have panic attacks or anxiety. But it also shows them within the session that they can do this. And if they practice it regularly, just that one little element, which could be involved in a hypnotic induction or mindfulness meditation, right, can really help to empower the patient to understand their physiology and their reactions to things. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the ANS and the autonomic nervous system and the peripheral nervous system and how you might view that in the work you do, since you do pulmonary stuff. I don't know if that comes up for you or if you've even thought about that.
I haven't thought all that much about it, other than I know hypnosis can affect the autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with patients with functional neurological disorders, mm-hmm. who respond very well to hypnosis. Mm-hmm. But I think that my general approach is fairly similar in that I'll teach a patient to calm themselves. Mm-hmm. I teach the patient, and if that's not sufficient, so again, 2/3 of my medical patients, that's enough, just calming. And then, of course, the autonomic nervous system gets calm as well. Mm-hmm. But then I teach the patient to understand themselves better through interacting with their subconscious. And then that's true across the board, no matter what they come with. That those are two basic steps. And then, depending on their issue, we'll move on. Do you have a specific thought about the autonomic nervous system that I could react to?
Well, we all have one, that's for sure. No, I was just wondering if you see that as being I'm sure it's a huge chunk of what goes on with pulmonary issues. That's all.
Sure.
Because of breathing and cardiology.
Sure. I don't typically think in that fashion. I know, okay, what you're saying.
Okay.
I work with patients, I should say, with dysautonomia as well. This, okay, function of the autonomic nervous system, they, okay, respond very well to hypnosis,
yeah,
as well.
Okay, good. Okay. You have touched a little bit on this, but maybe you can be touch on it a little bit more explicitly. The difference between hypnosis with adults in your practice, if you ever see adults, or if you've ever worked with them, versus children and adolescents. What's the difference there?
Sure. So I've had some experience with, quite a bit of experience with young adults into the mid-20s, and then some experiences with older adults. A couple of them were my colleagues. I did a special favor. And I guess the oldest adult I ever worked with was an 85-year-old lady with habit cough, and I took her on because she had a pulmonary issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my experience. The differences I've seen are these. So first of all, adults have much more baggage. They have much more things to deal with. First, you need to demystify hypnosis a lot more readily with adults than children. Children just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Adults, I think, are more resistant to change. Change is threatening. So an example I give is, let's say you have anxiety as a child, I'll teach you how to calm yourself, and that might be all you need to do, is just calm yourself. An adult who has had lifelong anxiety, their life has been built around the anxiety. So if the anxiety was to improve, how would their life change? Will their spouse still like them? Will they'll still like their job? And so I think it's more threatening to change, and therefore they're more resistant to change. Children between the ages of 8 and 12 have no issues using their imagination. Hypnosis is based in the imagination. Adults who have not thought in that way for a while may have more difficulty in learning. But I think the adults I work with have been successful. Just that they have also multiple causes of their symptoms. So one of the things that I think medicine suffers from is treating the symptom. And I think the best way to help patients is to treat the underlying causes. In an adult, it could be multiple underlying causes of a symptom, much more so than in a child. So it takes a lot longer, in my experience, to unravel.
Yes, I think that's I think along the way, the psychosocial development that happens and the issues of attachment or core conflictual relational issues, they're going to show up in some way, shape, or form. And how do you address that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You really like working with kids, don't you?
I love working with kids. I mean, that's why I'm in pediatrics. I was predated my time with hypnosis. I think kids are open to input. Mm-hmm. They have to. That's how they grow. And kids, you know, I love working with adolescents. They really, when you listen to them and you really help them figure out what they know, that they're wonderful human beings. One of the things I help coach parents of adolescents, and one of the big lessons is listen to your child and don't negate. Even if you don't agree with it, don't negate it. Listen it. Work with it. Because adolescents, I found, are typically very amenable to rethinking things. They have to. That they're growing. They're rethinking all the time. And so it's a fertile ground in which to work.
It must be really amazing to see the work you've done take root, you know, and start to grow in a younger child or a child adolescent, right? And to see how that's affected them positively over the lifespan. I'm curious if you've actually bumped in, and this is a general question to a physician, right? Have you met someone you have seen from a very early age later on in life and seen how you might have had those ripple effects of positivity for them?
Yes, I've been privileged to seeing that in a few of my patients. So they're in their 20s and late 20s now because they were kids when I first met them. And what's interesting to me is like, I remember one young man who had anxiety. I met him at 16 or so. Did really well with hypnosis, did well with his subconscious, got himself in order. In his late 20s, got really stressed out in life and started drinking. And he knew that was wrong. He recognized it. He went to a psychiatrist who told him, or psychologist told him he needed a new girlfriend. He had broken up, and he knew that was the wrong advice. And he finally told me about it, and I said, "Let me talk to your subconscious." "No, no, no," he says. Because he's kept in touch over the years. "I don't want to be your therapist. I don't want you to be my therapist again." And I said, "Okay." And then a couple months later, again, he was still struggling. I said, "Let me talk to your subconscious." So I did. It was one time. I talked for 10 minutes on the phone and straightened him out. And he was fine thereafter. And I've actually been fascinated. So some of these kids who are really good at hypnosis, are really good at tapping into themselves, I find it fascinating they don't do that routinely throughout life. That if I remind them they can do it, then it works great. And I've actually wondered about that. I've wondered why people who are so aware of who they are and what abilities they have, they don't access it. And sometimes I think that, well, maybe, you know, as humans, we're supposed to sort of meander our way through life and not tap into this knowledge.
Follow the bouncing ball, so to speak, yeah.
I wonder, do you have any thoughts about that? I'm curious. I don't know why people don't access themselves.
As you're sitting there, I'm thinking, why the hell don't I access that more often? you must have the same question to yourself sometimes, like, because you get so bogged down, or it's almost like we'll use the metaphor of the railroad tracks, right? Sometimes you forget that you're not only are you the train on the tracks, and the tracks taking you on the track of life is taking you in a certain direction, but you're also the switchmaster. You forget there's a switchmaster somewhere in your head that can take you down a different track of exploration. You know, like for me, one of my things as a kid is I'm the youngest of seven in a big Irish Catholic family. And, you know, my parents were a little tired of raising people when I was around. So I didn't get certain life learnings. I didn't learn how to swim until a few years ago. I forced myself to take lessons and scare the hell out of myself every day in the pool at my apartment building. So I learned to float. And I realized that it's not an innate fear of getting water in my lungs. That's silly. The fear for an adult learner, at least, is the fact that you're not supposed to float. There's an innate fear, as you know, there's an innate fear in all humans when they develop depth perception that you know, you're afraid of falling. And so it's this fear of falling and catching yourself. And so I learned to catch myself and learned to float, that I could actually float on the water. And over time, I learned to do that. But that was a very concerted effort, right? But it changed things over time. It kind of naturally built that up. I guess that would be kind of like more of a in vivo exposure to the process, to the fear, until, like, yeah, you kind of have it. And now I can actually do things like every summer I'm on the Chicago River kayaking, and any day that I have a chance, I'm out, you know. And so,
but I wonder if you did hypnosis and had your subconscious tell you you're fine, if you could have short-circuited
a lot faster. Yeah, I think you're right. It's a good question. I did it the hard way, and it cost me a whole lot per session, more than that one or two hypnotic interactions would have cost me a lot of money, you know, as far as like more and more swimming lessons, you know. But you're right. But that's something that was just in my mind. And what other things, how else could you do things differently? What other, you know, can you realize that you're your own switch master? And not only that, if you realize your own switch master, how would your life change?
There's a threat of change again, right?
Yeah, that's a scary thing. Like, well, if I'm my switch master, you know, it's kind of like, what's the old Jerry Lewis movie where he's like, he's the nutty professor, right? Like, he's the professor, and then he takes the, are you going to turn into a Jekyll and Hyde? That might be some people's fears. Or is it not?
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, one of my 19-year-old patients who had anxiety, I hadn't seen him in several years. As he came in, his subconscious told him to come and see me. He talked to his subconscious. And so it was a long story, but basically the subconscious said he's going to undergo a transition. And I want you to guide him. And I said, well, how will I know what to tell him? He said, you already know what he's going to learn. And I said, well, why can't I just, if I already know, why can't I just tell him? He says, he has to experience it for himself. And maybe that's part of the answer, that you have to experience life without our subconscious guiding us, because that's part of the learning process. Yes.
You're going into like a very philosophical kind of area of medicine.
Right, but again, it's the patient. It's not my subconscious thing. It's the patient's teaching me this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's true. Right? I mean, you have to feel. You have to own it.
Yeah, I will tell you for myself. I often consult my subconscious because my patients push me there. So I've got, first of all, in therapy, sometimes I'll go into a quick hypnotic state to get an idea of what to do next. I'm sure that when I do therapy, and I think this is true of many therapists, that you're in hypnotic state as you're doing therapy, because I'll sometimes come out of a set therapeutic session and said, how do I ever think of these things to talk about? And I think that comes from the subconscious.
Yeah. Well, I often do that myself. Yeah. And it's, yeah, exactly. Whether in therapy or in hypnosis, certainly in hypnosis, I want to emulate that hypnotic state and touch in, into my own subconscious mind. But I guess my rule books are, I can do that then, but can I do that consistently? That would be kind of cool. We're going into the realm of the self-help. What is it? The realm of Esalen, right? We're going to be we'll be speaking at Esalen soon, which wouldn't be such a bad thing, probably, from what I hear. But the subtitle of your book is A Journey to the Center. Is that what you were getting at?
Yes, I think. We have a lot in our midst that we don't realize. If you want to go spiritual, I will tell you that, and some of my patients want to go there. You know, I think that we find access to the universe, to God, or to whatever you call it, within our center. And so I teach people how to tap into themselves.
Yeah, excellent. Wow. So is there a book number two in the works?
There is. Its tentative title is Partnering with Your Subconscious.
Cool. So
it's very on this cool topic we're discussing.
Awesome. And then you did mention before we started the tape rolling, as they used to say, before we started recording, we were talking about your mission behind the book. Can you speak a little bit to that as a clinician and just a human being?
Thank you. So, 7 years ago, I left a tenured position at Upstate to open up Centerpoint Medicine, which is my pediatric full-time pediatric hypnosis and counseling practice. I wanted to demonstrate that it's possible to do this for a physician full-time to do this and make a living, and I've demonstrated it's possible. In fact, I now have six more colleagues working with me in La Jolla, California, where I'm based.
Awesome.
But I've seen the power of hypnosis, and like nobody seems to know about it. And it's a shame because so many people are suffering, and if with a 5-minute session of hypnosis, they can feel better, then why shouldn't they know about it and learn about it? So my life mission at this time is to spread the word. So the book is one part of this. So the book was written for the public to help people understand how hypnosis works. I don't think there's another book like it out there, and I'm hoping to see the public reading it and telling their friends, and if the book can go viral, that would be wonderful. And then I'm also in the process of franchising my practice. So I want to teach other physicians to do what I do through teaching them about hypnosis, teaching them how to, and actually giving them support for several years, because as you know, when you start doing hypnosis, a lot of questions come up. And I'm prepared to do that as a way of spreading the word and spreading the impact of hypnosis. That's the goal. So the book is one part of it.
Awesome.
And I'm hoping that your listening audience can take part in this mission. First off, of course, read the book and then pass it along if you think it's worthy passing along.
Okay. Excellent.
I should say when you think it's worthy of passing along, put that suggestion in there.
Oh, that was sneaky. You sneaked a suggestion in there. That's okay. It's a good suggestion. It's not a negative suggestion. You weren't selling us any swamp property in Florida, so that's good. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this amazing discussion we're having here?
I would love to encourage your listening audience to find out more about hypnosis. Mm-hmm. There are many resources. We should mention the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, and their website is asch.net. The Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis website.
SCEH.us.
Right. And please mention APA 30. I don't know.
Oh, APA's Division 30. I don't have the website offhand. I'll put links for all of this, including Dr. Ambar's practice in the footnotes of the notes for the show, and a link for his book, and you name it. It'll all be there. So, yes. So if people want to learn more, they can go to those various places on the web for training and understanding and enlightenment. Anything else?
I think that covers it from my end. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and with your audience.
Yes, I hope the audience appreciate it. I'm sure they will.
thank you for listening to the Psychology Talk podcast. This podcast is intended for informative and entertainment purposes only. If you need a mental health professional, please seek one out. All material, copyright, the Psychology Talk podcast. Music is provided by the oddly Italianate named band Serenati? Ciao.